ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The whole site's wiped out now. The buildings are unrepairable. They've been damaged. The water was nearly up to the roof.
Residents have finally been able to return to flood-ravaged towns in outback Queensland, but they're finding devastation that has some weighing up their futures. Also this afternoon, I reckon it's a fair bet a majority of Australians don't spend a huge amount of time thinking about the dirt under their feet, specifically what's in it and how healthy it is. A young man has travelled all the way from India to change that, and he thinks Australia has a chance to be a global leader in soil health.
It's turning into desert. The organic matter that is in the soil, it's dying. The microbes, if you just get one teaspoon of soil, there are trillions of microbes in that.
I'm Pia Wersu, and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Lutruwita, Tasmania, bringing you stories from across regional and remote Australia. First this evening, that story of residents returning home after a tough few weeks. After significant flooding inundated remote towns in outback Queensland 2 weeks ago, residents are finally able to return. But the level of destruction they've found has left some weighing up their options.
Oh, look, there's washed out stumps under houses, there's potholes up to your chest, you know, like with silt.
Our reporter Aaron Kelly is on the ground there. Thanks so much for joining us. Can you remind listeners just how widespread this flooding has been?
Good evening. Yeah, this has well and truly been a once-in-a-generation flooding event after nearly double the yearly average of rainfall was dumped across outback Queensland. Some towns out here morphed into islands, as well as dozens of properties surrounding those areas. Across the impacted area, which is double the size of Victoria, graziers are counting the costs as well, with stock losses reaching more than 173,000 livestock. The message we've heard from locals since we've been here loud and clear is that the road to recovery is going to take not months but years.
Some pretty mind-blowing numbers there, trying to wrap our head around. You've been to the southwest Queensland town of Adervale. What did you see there?
Utter devastation, to sum it up in two words. It was like a war zone when we visited there yesterday, like a bomb had gone off. And when we arrived yesterday, it was quite confronting for us out there with the residents. I just can't comprehend what it was like for those people who call Adervale home. They call it their, you know, it's a tiny community. It's not big, but a lot of people have spent their whole life there, and for them to return to their homes and livelihoods, which were literally swallowed by raging floodwaters. You know, we sat there with a few of the locals yesterday, and you know, in their homes, which were, you know, laid with mud, they were showing us videos of that exact same spot where we were sitting or standing yesterday, and they were showing us videos of how high and how forceful that water was, and it was mind-blowing. It really was. And they're doing it tough. While it's going to be a long road to recovery, it's they've already begun. And that was the first question I asked a lot of the people yesterday: well, where do you begin and how do you begin? And their response was, you know, just put one foot in front of the other and get on with it. So it's remarkable, the resilience of the people in this community.
And certainly that's something that's come through in some of the audio you've gathered there. You spoke to someone called Annie Liston, who was talking about the power of the community in these situations. Let's hear a little bit of what she had to say.
My heart went out to everyone, but the SES, the Rural Fire Brigade, the Fire Brigade and everybody else have just been absolutely wonderful.
Certainly sounds like we're seeing that incredible spirit that comes together in these really troubling times where people band together by the sounds of things. You mentioned that you were able to go back into that town with residents yesterday. Was that the first time that residents had been allowed back into Adervale?
Yeah, it was. It was. So on Tuesday this week, the road between Quilpie and Adervale was reopened. They were bused from here back to face their reality and, I guess, a new reality.
What does the future of this town look like?
Yeah, good question. And it's one that has reared its head again since this event a couple of weeks ago. Back in 1963, the town recorded one of its biggest floods. And a year later, the township held a vote whether to shift the community to higher ground, only a couple of k's away from where it is to this day. But that vote went against, and the town, you know, has stayed here. And I guess it's put that question back into people's minds. I guess it's a question for down the track, but right now emotions are still very raw for people to even comprehend leaving the tiny town of Adavale.
And obviously a really difficult road ahead for all the residents there as they try and look at what comes next. You did speak to Ted Robinson, a Vietnam vet who had just got a new veterans retreat almost ready for opening. Let's take a listen to what he had to say.
A bit of an emotional roller coaster. One day I want to walk away and never come back, and then I think of the fantastic people out here and what they've done and how well the Yabby Bar was serving the community and the friends we've made and the whole thing. And then I think we will eventually rebuild, but it'll take a while, but I think it'll come back.
Yeah, look, Ted's an absolute trooper. We've spent the last couple of nights with him here in Quilpie, and just what a lot of people didn't realise is when he was rescued off the roof of his off the Yabby Bar, he put his wife Pip into the helicopter first, and she was taken to higher ground, and another helicopter came in to pick Ted up, and it actually he couldn't take off due to the force of the water, and that helicopter ended up in the water, and the pilot ended up down a few hundred metres away, washed into floodwaters. He luckily grabbed onto a tree and then was rescued from that tree and taken to high ground. And Ted suffered serious burns to his body from the helicopter fuel. And you know, Ted spent the first few days in hospital after being evacuated from his little town of Adavale. But he's been back there since the roads reopened, and you know, he's been starting the cleanup, and he's determined to get the Adavale Veterans Retreat back on track and back up and running. And it'll take time, but you know, with people like Ted in it, in the community, it'll happen. It won't happen overnight, but it will happen.
Sounds like the buildings might be damaged, but the heart of the community is still very much alive. Aaron Kelly, thanks so much for joining Australia Wide.
ABC Australia Wide.
Well, while residents in Queensland are struggling to come to terms with the devastation left behind after those floods, in other parts of Australia, it's a very different story. The southeast of South Australia and southwest Victoria have traditionally been known for being wetter and cooler than most other parts of the country. But right now, it's experiencing drought conditions, which is starting to affect an industry which has a big role to play in Australia's future housing needs. Sam Bradbrook has this report.
The roads around the Green Triangle forestry region are lined with thousands of hectares of bright green pine plantations. But with much of the region in drought conditions, shades of brown now tinge that green landscape, with thousands of trees either dying or experiencing heat stress.
From the imagery we're seeing, it's widespread. It affects Western Victoria and South Australia, so that entire Green Triangle region. The Green Triangle is renowned for structural timber. We're one of the most important plantation regions in Australia, and this will feed directly into that entire supply chain around housing and other high-value products.
Green Triangle Forest Industries Hub General Manager Tony Wright says this year has been one of the driest on record.
It affects the growth rate. So trees that would tend to shut down, particularly softwood, they'll tend to they take the water that's available to them in the environment, but they obviously have a limitation about how deep they can go. They will start to shut down their growth. These are 30-year crops. An impact on growth in any particular year will affect the yield at the end of that rotation.
The region is known for reliable rainfall and for an extensive groundwater system. But as the industry prepares for a warmer and drier climate, researchers are studying the damaged trees to get ready for the future.
We don't have any science or data of a comparable period, but we are, through the Forestry Centre of Excellence and University of South Australia, doing a lot of work on the science of plantations, water use, and the impact of scarcity on plantations.
The Green Triangle's forestry plantations cover 334,000 hectares and support around 4,000 jobs. The full effects of the current drought might not be apparent for decades. Such is the lifespan of a plantation. University of South Australia Forestry Centre of Excellence Director Jeff Morrell says disease is now a worry.
It's like after you have a fire, some trees survive and then they gradually die off. Here we're looking at trees that are stressed, and it will take a while for some of that to really show up. The other part of that will be, because those trees are stressed, we'll start to see some insects and diseases start to become a problem, and that can build on itself.
The Green Triangle supplies around 34% of Australia's structural timber for home construction. While there's no immediate impact on the building industry, there's likely to be less wood entering the market once the drought-affected trees are mature. Master Builders Australia Chief Executive Will Frogley says he wants Australia to have a more self-sufficient timber supply.
A lot of Australians would probably be shocked to know that we import a lot of timber for our industry. It also comes from other states. But I think, yeah, most people would think in a country like Australia, it's quite incredible that we haven't been able to develop enough timber supply for our local building industry. It probably highlights some problems and mistakes that have been made over the years.
With weather forecasts not predicting any significant rain for the region in the near future, the Green Triangle is expecting tough conditions to continue. Mr. Wright says the uncertainty around how it will affect timber supplies is what has the industry worried.
The Green Triangle is renowned for structural timber. The Green Triangle really is the jewel in the crown of the forest industry in Australia, and anything that affects our productivity will be felt in the Australian market.
Green Triangle Forest Industries Hub General Manager Tony Wright finishing that report there from Sam Bradbrook with reporting by Elsie Adamo.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
I don't want to put a killjoy on their fabulous family tradition, but
that was just mayhem and chaos.
The majority of them are still buying their trees, regardless of the snake.
So this is the first time we've opened the slide this summer.
On ABC Radio.
It might have been a while since you were smashing mud pies when your parents' back was turned, but I wonder if you've ever stopped to think what exactly might be in the humble old mud pie made of dirt. Well, a 19-year-old from India, Sahil Jar, does think about that a lot, and it's got him cycling 20,000 kilometres across 20 countries in four continents to try to save soil from extinction. And he started that journey in Bundaberg, Queensland. Along the way, he's meeting farmers, locals and leaders, and ABC's Kim Honan.
Good day, mates. My name is Sahil and I am from India. I am set out to learn from the world and share what I have learned across many different regions.
And why did you decide to start your trip in Australia?
Well, I'm proud to say this. Australia is probably the only country in our entire planet which has specific focus on soil health. There's something called as Soil Science Australia, a body to protect soil, and a mission on a national level to protect soil. This is what you want in every other nation of our planet. Only if we do this can we protect our soil.
And your plan is to visit farmers along the way and, you know, check out the soil firsthand and some of the practices that they're doing to improve soil health?
Based on my interactions with farmers from across India and Australia, I believe farmers know more than scientists and me. They know what's the problem, they know what is the solution. We can still support them, but the real people that we need to speak with is people, especially from younger generations and people who live in urban areas, who are the people who consume food grown by the farmers.
And what do you think the solution is? How do you think we should prevent, or how do you think we can prevent soil from becoming extinct?
Well, why is soil going to get extinct? It's turning into desert. Why is that happening? It's the organic matter that is in the soil, it's dying. The microbes, if you just get one teaspoon of soil, there are trillions of microbes in that. And they are dying because of excessive use of chemical fertilizers. Chemicals are needed to some extent to feed the global population that we have. But excessive use just kills the microbes in the soil. Apart from that, keeping the soil open under direct sunlight, the microbes which are present inside it comes on the open surface. And when in touch with sunlight, they just die. So to save soil, we need to bring green cover, say grasses, bushes, trees, cover crops back to the soil. And we have to decrease the use of chemical fertilizers. And we also have to do practices which are sustainable and regenerative. So for real solution, we need specific laws and policies in each and every nation of our planet. That, let's say I hold 10 acres of land. By law, I have to maintain a minimum of 3 to 6% of organic matter in the soil. It has to be under the law. If that doesn't happen, the food that we are growing won't have enough nutrients to supply us on a daily basis. And the food anyways will not be able to grow in the next few years.
And are you hoping to meet with the Prime Minister of Australia while you're here to discuss the government's soil policy?
Well, I would love to meet him, not to discuss the soil policy as such, but to give him the voice of the people, the millions of people who have been supporting Save Soil movement, particularly people from Australia, that they need something like this. And I would love that Australia takes this up and becomes a role model for rest of the world.
And are you going to get your hands dirty while you're here in Australia?
Well, why not?
Did you hear that? Are you going to put him to work here on the farm at 560?
There's plenty to do, yeah. So there's a couple of shovels, but no. He's got a big journey ahead, so I'll give him a break today. What a legend, huh?
And soils is something that's extremely important to you and your farming operation here at South Gundarimba.
Oh, incredibly. And we've seen the results. And it's didn't take long, you know. We've never really used chemicals. We've been certified organic, but we're sort of upping our ante to more regenerative, where it's serving itself in that point. And it's minimal work. And it's hard to explain to people just a few simple practices and how easy it is to reduce that chemical use and to offer a better product.
What kind of easy changes can farmers be making to improve soil health?
Well, like Sahil said, basic ones, like keep that soil covered. Don't have to plough up fields or do cover cropping or green manuring or plant some trees or create habitat zones. There's so many things you can do, but you may have to take a loss for a little while, but it'll come back. And nature always gives back if you look after it, I've noticed.
What are the benefits you've seen from improved soil health? You've been hit with, you know, flood after flood, and just trying to retain that soil has been extremely important.
Oh, you're right. And yes, 3 weeks ago, as I was explaining, we're underwater here, but we live next to a river, I expect that. But we just did a soil test a week and a half ago, and my microbial life, my fungal life is off the charts. It was the highest that the auditor and trainer ever had seen, which was really a nice surprise for me after what we'd been through. But gets me a bit emotional, but it's working. And the benefits I'm seeing with the people are, you know, just common people are saying it lasts longer in the fridge, it tastes better, it looks better, all those common things that you don't hear when you shop at the supermarket too much, yeah? Support local.
Pepe Fasos at 560 Farms on the New South Wales North Coast, ending that story from Kim Honan.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
A grieving mum from the Kimberley region in northern Western Australia is fighting one of Australia's biggest superannuation funds to get her son's death benefits paid to his child and beneficiaries. Australian Super is already being sued by the corporate watchdog for allegedly having lengthy delays in processing members' death benefits. National Consumer Affairs reporter Michael Atkin has the story, and a warning. This includes the name and voice of someone who has died, used with the permission of the family.
At the peak of the COVID pandemic, Warwick Deegan applied for early access to his superannuation. But when the Nigina man, who lived in a remote community in Western Australia's Kimberley region, didn't receive the $10,000, he called Australian Super. On this recording, Mr. Deegan repeatedly asked what would happen if the money had gone into the wrong bank account.
It will bounce back for sure, right?
Yeah, it will bounce back to Australian Super.
The father of one made repeated visits to his nearest ANZ bank, some 40 minutes away, but the money wasn't in his account. Months later, the 36-year-old died by suicide. His mother, Annette Riley, says trouble with money was a factor, and she's still grappling with his loss.
It is upsetting because he was going to the bank just about every day checking his account.
Australian Super says the money was paid to the bank account provided by the tax office, and Mr. Deegan should have checked the account details when making his application. But financial counsellor Alan Gray questions whether Australian Super did enough to ensure it had the correct details. ANZ later confirmed the money was paid into someone else's account, but it couldn't say more due to privacy restrictions.
Australian Super have no idea who they're paying that COVID super money to because they don't match the account name with the BSB and account number.
Warwick Deegan's family wants the $10,000 to be paid back and for the super fund to reinstate his death benefit, an amount of $180,000 for his teenage daughter. Australian Super cancelled the benefit shortly before he died because there had been no contributions for 16 months, so the account was deemed inactive. Alan Gray claims Australian Super didn't properly warn Mr. Deegan and failed to offer him additional support as a remote First Nations person.
I have no doubt the experience of my client Annette and her son is being replicated in remote Aboriginal communities all around Australia.
Alan Gray says two warning letters were sent to an old address and returned to sender. And in the calls, Australian Super didn't check Mr. Deegan's contact details were up to date.
And I really believe that the CEO of Australian Super needs to bang some heads together and exercise some compassion.
Annette Riley took the case to the Australian Financial Complaints Authority, but she lost. It found Australian Super had acted fair and reasonably.
They should pay the death insurance for my granddaughter.
Last month, the corporate watchdog, the Australian Securities and Investments Commission, released a review which was highly critical of how 10 other super funds have dealt with death benefits. ASIC Commissioner Simone Constant says the review found the outcomes were even worse for First Nations families, especially when they live remotely.
When it came to the Indigenous group, the First Nations groups within this, we found that the service failings and the gaps that many members and their families have been facing into were amplified or exacerbated.
In a statement, Australian Super said it felt deeply for Mr. Deegan and his family, but maintained it had followed all laws and processes correctly. Chief Member Officer Rose Curlin said while it provided cultural training to staff and had a dedicated phone line for Indigenous members, Mr. Deegan's case showed the need for widespread improvement.
This shows systemic changes to laws and industry standards are needed to better serve vulnerable Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, particularly in remote areas.
And that's an actor finishing that story by Michael Atkin.
ABC Australia Wide.
When the fire came through, it was just like a ball of flame, basically.
On ABC Radio.
I'm sure it's not escaped your attention by now that we are well and truly in election mode, with politicians vying for your vote. There are, as every election, a tranche of new voters yet to make up their minds. They're going to be the ones shaping future elections, so how are they feeling about this one? The ABC's Adrian Reardon headed along to Lumen Christi Catholic College in Pambula Beach, in the seat of Eden Monaro, in the southeast corner of New South Wales. A seat made up of a lot of retirees, but she was there to hear from the students.
I'm Daniel Byrne, I'm 18 years old and I'm from Maroombula.
Are you voting in the upcoming federal election?
I enrolled last night actually, I think I have to now.
What's on the front of your mind as a voter?
Well, the cost of living, I guess, when I'm older. Housing prices are going up though, so.
Do you worry about then, since you want to go away and study, how you might afford like rent and paying for groceries and stuff like that?
Yeah, I guess a little. I have three older siblings that have gone away and studied. And they've all gone pretty well. But I think dad does help them out. Maybe for some other people who don't have that opportunity to get that help, they might be struggling more.
Do you know who you might want to vote for?
No clue. My sister's told me stuff and my dad's told me stuff. And they're both two different people, so I got no clue.
Hey, I'm Stephanie Taylor. I'm from Kallaroo and I'm 17.
I'm Bianca Bogue. I'm 17 years old. I'm from Pambula.
Are you enrolled for the May 3rd election?
No.
No, we're not. Are you disappointed that you're not going to be able to vote?
Yes.
Not really.
Why are you disappointed that you're not able to vote?
Because I feel like the younger voices need more of an opinion on our future.
What would you like to see it lower to, like 16?
Yeah, I reckon 16 is a good number.
Well, even though you're not voting, what issues matter to you?
Mental health. Just like, I feel like there needs to be more awareness of it and more advocates for it.
Yeah, I feel like it needs to be more of a public thing as opposed to, you know, just having headspace and having it be more accessible to people in schools and stuff like that. I feel like if I educated myself a bit more, then I would be more enticed to vote. Like, my family's not super political and they don't really go either way. They're kind of just random voters and will do whatever.
Besides mental health, what really matters to you?
Climate change. It's just something that's happening all the time.
I feel like potentially having more accessible opportunities for young people as well. Mm. Like, a lot of us have to move away in order to achieve what we want.
My name's Isaac. I'm 18. I'm from Eden. Yeah, I've already enrolled.
What issues are on the front of your mind?
Just living after leaving home.
Do you know who you might want to vote for?
The Liberals, I think. Yeah.
And why do you want to vote for the Liberal Party?
Oh, that's what, at home, that's pretty much all I hear, so might do the same.
Do you know the Liberal candidate? Joe Vanderplaat, have you?
Oh, I've seen a lot on the ads. And every second house normally has one on the lawns.
My name is Reese Finn-Yong. I'm from Marimbula and I'm 18.
My name's Lara Carroll and I'm from Bega and I'm 17.
How do you feel about voting your first election?
Didn't really think about it too much until my mum reminded me the other day that I had to enrol for voting.
And how do you feel, I guess, not being able to vote?
Relieved. Don't have to go down. And if I don't do it, I don't have to pay a fine. So I'm happy.
Do you know what federal seat we are in?
No.
No. That's okay. We're in Eden Monaro, it's called.
But... Oh, yeah.
I knew that.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I knew that, yeah.
Cost of fuel is a major problem for me. Living rural, like, fuel costs add up a lot. I think I'd probably vote for Labor over Liberal, yeah.
Why is that?
I don't really know. It's just talk of my mum. My family's all voting for Labor.
What about you, Laura? I know you can't vote, but like, what issues on the front of your mind?
Definitely fuel. I'm spending a lot of money each week driving half an hour each day to get to school. Obviously, living when I leave school is going to be a bit nerve-wracking because I'm probably not going to be able to buy a house, but it's okay.
Do you find politics difficult to understand or do you find it interesting?
I find it very difficult. I feel like we don't learn enough even in school about it.
I'm Caitlin Stanger. I'm really interested in, like, the environmental side of it and rights of, like, women rights, especially in America right now. And you can kind of see it's kind of reflecting on Australian politics a lot and just seeing how it's slowly making its way to Australia, and it's very concerning. I'll probably vote for more of, like, the Greens, or I saw, like, a lot, but, yeah, I think it's definitely worth doing more research beforehand.
There were some high school students from Pambula Beach on the New South Wales far south coast there, speaking with the ABC's Adrian Reardon.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
There's nothing that tells you you're out in the great outdoors like this sound. But it's a hard world for our beloved frogs. The underground life of the giant southern burrowing frog is very secretive, and that's made it hard for researchers to help secure their population. But that's starting to change. Danielle Pope has the story.
The southern giant burrowing frog is a robust fellow with big silver eyes, chocolate brown in colour, with yellow splotches running down the side. The males look like they could probably bench press about 10 kilos and have spikes on their fingers. They're elusive, and that's made saving them tricky for researchers like Melbourne Zoo's Ryan Mose.
Populations are in pretty dire straits. It's hard to get an exact idea of what the populations are doing because we're dealing with some frogs that are very, very cryptic, very, very hard to find and survey for in the wild, particularly the southern giant burrowing frogs. You know, this is a species that spends, you know, 90% of its time over the year underground. So it's hard to know exactly what the populations are doing. But it's pretty safe to say that threats and threatening processes that they're facing, the populations aren't doing overly well.
Those threats include bushfire. And unfortunately, the Gippsland region of East Victoria has seen a lot of those in recent years, including the devastating Black Summer fires.
I mean, there's a number of other threatening processes that these frogs have to deal with in the wild. Logging of their forests and particularly salvage logging after fires. You've got climate change driven effects, and disease is probably the other primary threatening process.
And so enter researchers at Melbourne Zoo. If they can breed these frogs in captivity, they can secure the species' survival. And breed them they have, successfully replicating the conditions that the southern giant burrowing frog need to breed.
For us, it was really trying to understand what those environmental parameters are that encourages the breeding behaviours in these frogs, because frog behaviour is really sort of dictated by the climates and the weather, and certain environmental parameters will trigger certain behaviours. So for us, it was about figuring out and understanding what those environmental parameters were and how can we replicate that in our captive breeding programs in order to encourage that breeding behaviour. You know, one of the key goals for these breeding programs is to breed genetically robust frogs for release back into the wild. So eventually we hope to get to a point where we can produce these frogs en masse so that we can repopulate those wild populations.
And that's Melbourne Zoo's Ryan Mose ending that report from Danielle Pope in Gippsland. And that's Australia Wide for this week. I'm Pia Wursu. If you want to catch up on anything or are looking for some weekend listening, you can listen back to the podcast of the show. Just search for Australia Wide on the ABC Listen app. And we always love to hear from you as well. Let us know what's happening in your part of the world by emailing australiawide.radio@abc.net.au. Have a great weekend.
ABC Listen.